This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. A little free association to start the show today. Vermont auto racing tracks. Does Thunder Road in Barrie pop to mind? How about race car drivers? I'm guessing Phil Scott is on the tip of your tongue. Our lieutenant governor and now gubernatorial candidate is probably as well known for his exploits on the track as he is for his work at the State House. A few years ago, he talked with Vermont Edition about his love of racing.
I've been involved in it since I was 17. My mom, she's the race fan, and she was the one that brought us as kids to Thunder Road. There's a number of different classes of cars, and I race in the top-tiered class, the fastest of the cars, and they're fairly sophisticated. The chassis are all handmade. When they say they're stock cars, there's nothing stock about stock cars.
That's Phil Scott at Thunder Road in 2011. But if that's your knowledge of Vermont's relationship to car racing, and that's where it begins and ends, it's time to dig a little bit deeper. Vermont has a rich history of racing, one that some people are trying to keep afloat. I'm joined today by Bill Latibush, Vermont racing historian. He runs catamountstadium.com. It's a website devoted to the now-shuttered stock car racing track in Milton. And he's also the author of To Beat the Beaver, a biography of legendary driver and Vermont native Beaver Dragon. Bill, it's a pleasure to have you on Vermont Edition.
Well, thanks, Jane. Pleasure to be here.
So when was the heyday of Vermont auto racing?
Well, there's been a couple of heydays. In the very early 1950s, the sport absolutely burgeoned. There were 22 tracks running concurrently, if you want to dignify some of them by calling them tracks. And the next surgence came along in the 60s, and then actually probably your golden period is the 70s and the end of the Catamount era.
The 70s is not that long ago.
No, not really.
So what happened?
Racers for decades have been their own worst enemies. They want something that's new and more expensive all the time. That's one of the things that happened. Most of the tracks, including Catamount and even today Bear Ridge, fight with neighbors who move in next to the track and then want the track dismembered. There's a number of things. In the case of Catamount, they kind of missed the shift a little bit and sold the land off thinking the sport was going down. And when it resurged, they couldn't get a renewal of the lease, and the track was torn up a week after the last show. So it kind of depends, but cost has a lot to do with it.
And Catamount, this is the one that has really captured your interest over the years. You've started this whole website that is devoted to a lot of things, but in part devoted to this racetrack.
It started with that.
Well, what's so great about it?
It was a remarkable track. The location was good. Some of the drivers who participated there went on to almost a national prominence. And that I shouldn't just say drivers, mechanics, car builders, the announcer, you know, Ken Squire, and so on.
And Ken Squire
was a very significant track.
Let's talk about Ken Squire since you mentioned him. A lot of people may know he's the owner of WDEV, the radio station in Waterbury.
Right.
He's also hugely important to the sport of auto racing, to motorsport journalism, and to Vermont auto racing. So tell us a little bit about him.
What I can tell you is he did start that way, and apparently from what I can learn as a teenager, would ride his bicycle to nearby tracks and announce there because he was better than anyone trying to do it. And later on, I guess he became in such demand, he ended up in Chittenden County, and I believe even as far as Keene, New Hampshire, announcing. He just had a knack
for it.
You
mean even
when
he was a kid?
Right. And then as a young man.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, when he got into the more national stage, he was one of the ones that brought it into great prominence and was able to bring the Daytona 500 into a full viewing and things of that nature.
When you say into a few viewings, so he was the commentator on TV, and he was one
right.
of the guys pushing to say sports fans are going to want to watch this
right.
whole race. And prior to that, it was just see the
parts
highlights.
Parts of it, yes.
And he was right, as it turns out.
It turns out, yeah.
And he was instrumental in getting Catamount Stadium founded as well, right?
Yeah, you spoke of the Northeastern Speedway with Paul Belfay is going to be on later. he announced over there and was so impressed by that track that he started his own in 1960 in Barrie along with the Cooley brothers, Thunder Road. And then in a five-year period, he and other men decided to build Catamount because of the prime location that they had in Chittenden County.
So Catamount Stadium in Milton, you know, it sounds very grand, but how big was the track? What did it look like?
Third mile, well-banked paved track, and started out with the bleachers that had been put up for the LBJ inaugural parade, brought over in an ice storm and put up there. And I guess the track was pretty much thrown together in about a month's time. The worst problem they had, according to Ken, was they couldn't get water. And his friend and eventual pit steward, Archie Blackadar, lived in Danville, where all the dousers are. And they actually had to bring in a dowser a few days before the track, and he hit water. And they had, the well dillers are hardly coming out of the track when they were bringing the cars in. It was that close.
So you must have gone to a bunch of races there in your days.
I did, yeah. Once I moved up in 68, I did. I actually came from the Rutland area, but a ton of races, yeah.
Any still stick in your mind as really great races?
At Catamount, I don't know. There were so many that I can't say that I do remember. Unfortunately, I didn't even get to see the last race there. Kind of a poetic justice or balance thing. Jean-Paul Cabana, the famous Canadian driver, won the first race at Catamount in a NASCAR Sportsman Coupe, and he also won the last race there in an ACT plastic-bodied late model.
We're talking today about Vermont's auto racing history and the dirt and paved racetracks that people used to go watch these races on. A lot more used to be in existence than there are today, certainly. And if you're a car racing aficionado, if you have a question maybe about an old track that you remember or you want to tell us about a race that you went to, you can call 1-800-639-2211. Our number again is 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Bill, who did go to these races? What was the crowd like? All over the state, not just Catamount.
Probably for the most part, you know, blue-collar people. However, you did and still do have, you know, some folks who do come in who are, you know, prime movers and shakers. One of the highly involved people at Catamount was Jack DeBrule, who was probably best known for Automaster Motors. But Jack started out actually operating a speed shop on Lower Church Street, right in the city, and tried a number of different kinds of cars. He was an innovator, that's for sure. And but I think the backbone of racing has always been starting with the XGI and then the working man and the motorheads.
And was this the kind of scene that, you know, you still often see sometimes at NASCAR races where, you know, you'd take a cooler, you'd have a meal with you, you'd picnic and tailgate, and this would be a whole event rather than just the race that you were going to see?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's a very much a family thing. You got third generation drivers racing now in places, and I think the fans probably the same thing. They went to the same tracks as their grandfather had gone to, and it's a nice sport. It's a little expensive now for most people to participate in, but it's still a nice sport to go and view.
Why do you say that? You know, I think a lot of non-racing fans say, "Oh, it's just, you know, a lot of exhaust fumes and loud noise. What's so nice about it?"
Well, it depends on, I guess, how informed the people are who are watching it. Some just have their favorite driver and will cheer crazily. Others know what's going on and will sit there and say, you know, Phil Scott's really loose tonight. They're going to have to do something with that, or, you know, whatever the situation is. If it's a little different. You can watch pavement racing for hours. They practice for hours before because they have to cycle their tires in with temperatures and stuff. On dirt, there's almost no practice whatsoever. Usually the first race you see is the first action you see because the track doesn't hold up as well. And, you know, really, there are people sitting in the stands who know nothing, and there are people sitting in the stands who know as much as they do in the pits.
Well, you know, you mentioned that there were at one point 22 tracks around the state. Now I think there are only really three that are used with any frequency, right?
That's it. Devil's Bowl is run, although it's paved now. Thunder Road, of course, and then Bear Ridge, which was built in 68 specifically as a haven for the flathead engine cars that had been phased out of everywhere else.
So if there are only three now and they're all paved, you know,
no,
what?
No, Bear Ridge is dirt.
Oh, Bear Ridge is dirt?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So this is in Bradford. Bear Ridge is dirt.
That's correct.
And people still, you know, this sounds like it's one that's still pretty good. People still like to go. It's had some success in even on into today.
It had enormous feels when it opened. It went through periods where it had a hard time. It's almost like a New Hampshire track. It's so close. And they have a lot of trouble in New Hampshire keeping tracks healthy. But he is on an upsurge again, and he's come up with some ideas, including bringing in some sprint and midgets with their open wheel cars. And I guess it's doing very well. I haven't made it over there in a couple of years, but I really want to.
What about Devil's Bowl in West Haven or Fairhaven?
It, I think, is a fun place to go. It's pleasant. The racing's pretty good. He has trouble getting cars, to be honest. And, you know, it's because he's in an area where they live and breathe clay racing, and they're not getting it. So a lot of them go right past the track and go to Albany, Saratoga on Friday nights. But, you know, Mike is working very hard at it. I think it's a nice facility, and it's a good show. He does have a little dirt track built inside the other one. And, you know, seeing how that will work for him for limited shows.
So you think it was a bad move to pave it?
It wasn't his move. The Richards family that started the track paved it. I think their thought was they may not sell a dirt track because very few people know how to groom one.
Why? What does it take?
It C.J. Richards used to be out in the morning, even after a race Sunday night. He'd be out the next day paving it and graving it. I don't mean paving it, running it in and grading it.
Uh-huh.
And it has to be prepared, especially the hours before, very carefully. Otherwise, it's either so dusty you can't stand it, or with the modern race car chassis that digs in, it gets awfully rutted.
Are all the tracks that are used today used by the same classes of cars? I mean, you've got a lot of different kinds of race cars and classes and different styles of racing.
It's probably more... Bear Ridge has definitely its own. They're dirt cars. Thunder Road, as Phil had pointed out in your piece, has the late model, which is pretty much the same late model that Airborne tries to run and Devil's Bowl tries to run. The Flying Tiger or the Tiger Sportsman car, which is your second division down at Thunder Road, really doesn't exist at the other two tracks. Airborne and Devil's Bowl, which work together now, have what's called a Renegade, which is like a kind of a dumbed-down Tiger, frankly, no harder to drive, but it is reasonably priced. And then they all have four-cylinder classes.
We got a note from Lee who says, do you have any information on a racetrack in West Brattleboro on Route 9? We, the Brattleboro Historical Society, know of the racetrack, but we have very little, if any, information on it.
Yeah, they should check my site. It was called Brattleboro Speedway, and I know where the spot is, and I do have a page on it on the site. It was actually somewhat organized. The Triangle Racing Association down there had Rhythm Inn in northern Massachusetts. It had Brattleboro and at least one track in New Hampshire.
Let's go to Ralph, who's calling in from Enosburg. Hey, Ralph, go right ahead. You're on the air.
I just wonder if the fella remembers or knows anything about, I'm a retired logger, and a company that trucked my logs, Stowe and Sons Company, the matriarch of the family there, Marjorie Stowe, she was the first woman race car driver, I was told. I wonder if he can say anything about that, if you know.
I have not heard of her. I thought you were going to ask about the track that was in Enosburg, because you did have one, Enosburg Speedway, which is out on the Davis Road. But I can't say I have heard of Marjorie Stowe, but I certainly will probably try to. Is that Stowe?
Yes.
I might try to look something up on her, but I had not heard
it
of her.
Quite a while while ago. It was quite a while ago. I just wondered there. I got a kick out of that when I heard that.
So. Yeah, she might have tried the Enosburg track. I don't know.
So, you know, Marjorie Stowe, it sounds like you don't know her, but any race car drivers that did really cut their teeth in Vermont and go on to become something big in bigger tracks?
Yeah, what comes to mind, Kevin LePage, who ended up in, you know, what today is your Sprint Cup, or used to be called at that time the Grand National, Winston Cup, whatever it was when Kevin was there. Jamie Obey from North Ferrisburg, who is still running a little bit at Devil's Bowl, started at Catamount, was a two-time Busch Grand National North champion, which is quite a thing, and raced in the trucks, which is NASCAR's third division down. There are people like Steve Hibbard, who crewed for Bob Dragon, became very, very good, became an indispensable man, especially with racing shocks for people like Rusty Wallace, Roger Penske. And he runs a team now that races in called the K&N Series. It's almost like the Sprint Cup and the Infinity Series and whatever.
We're talking today about Vermont's auto racing history, and coming up, we're going to look at where things stand today and if there's still an appetite from fans to see small-scale car racing in the state. How do you get people away from their televisions and into the bleachers? We're also going to talk to the owner of one track that was restored about 6 years ago, and we'll hear from him why he thought that was a good idea. You can call in with your memories and reflections. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Bill Ladebush is a longtime motorsports fan and Vermont racing historian. He runs CatamountStadium.com. It's a website devoted to an old racing track in Milton, no longer working, but really important in his life. He's with us today telling stories about racing in the Green Mountain State. And if you have a memory to share, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. And let's go to Greg calling in from Williston. Hi, Greg. Go right ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I had a question. I have learned that Vermont Sports Car has partnered for some years with the Subaru Rally Team, and I was just wondering what impact that has had on the rally community in the state, and if there are any rallies that are currently going on. I know there's the Mount Philo Hill Climb, but other than that, I haven't really heard of anything.
Yeah, the Mount Philo Hill Climb, a yearly event in Charlotte in Chittenden County, going up the road there that leads up to the top of the hill. Bill, do you know anything about the rallying community?
Absolutely nothing, to tell you the truth. Stock cars, about it. I do know we had some pretty good drivers from Vermont. I think that's what Buffum used to do. It was very prominent, but I don't know much about it now.
All right. Well, if anybody does know and you can help Greg out, go to the Vermont Edition Facebook page, post a note there. Our Facebook page is open, so you don't have to like us to be able to see it, but we'll try to see if we can do some crowdsourcing there, Greg, to help you out. Anne is on the line with us from Essex Junction. Hi, Anne. Go right ahead.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to ask the gentleman if he's familiar with a dirt track that was in Colchester at the about Bay Road area of Colchester in the mid-50s.
There were five tracks in Colchester almost at once. One was on Williams Road on Briganti truck farm land. One was by the drive-in by the interstate. One was Bel Air Drive, essentially, behind the Catholic Church. There was one on the site of the Sunset Drive-In, and there was one on the way out of Colchester of where Canyon Estates is.
Huh. And do you have a reason for asking? Do you remember one?
Well, I remember my dad taking my sister and my brother and I there, one of my brothers and I there, probably, as I said, in the mid-50s. And, you know, there were no bleachers. It was just a rough circle in dirt in a field. And you stood around and dusty and, you know, and so on. But and the motors screaming and all of that. So it's a memory I have.
A good memory?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And a long time ago, right.
And
well,
thanks.
Thank you. I didn't know about the other tracks, and I actually lived on Bel Air Drive, but not when it was a racetrack.
And thanks for your call. Appreciate that. So, Bill, did that ring any bells for you when she's talking about that memory of it?
Not that basic a track, because Smitty's track, Colchester Raceway, out by Essex, was very organized, had bleachers and retaining barriers. Walter Barkham's track by the interstate by Lone Pine Campground was the same way. Now, I guess the Green Mountain track was kind of a chicken wire deal, and I don't know much about the other two. She might have seen, you know, maybe it was Sunset. I don't know. I'm just not certain.
Well, it's cool to hear memories of, you know, childhood memories that still, you know, still resonate, that you can still imagine the screaming of those engines. That's really cool, Ann.
Yeah.
Let's go to Mark in Grand Isle. Hey, Mark, go ahead.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I'm Mr. Ladderbush. I had you in fifth grade.
Yeah.
One of the things I remember.
You and thousands of others, Mark.
Good grades and good behavior. We'd get the cars.
Oh, yeah.
And watching the World Series in October in your classroom.
Yep.
So
those are good memories.
Mark, when you say when you got good grades, what happened? What would Bill Ladderbush do for you?
Well, he had these cards, like Russell Ingerson's car. He'd draw them on a great piece of paper, and they were all different race car drivers, Tom Tiller, all race car drivers that drove at Catamount and stuff like that. And when you get good grades, good behavior, these were a reward for that day.
Mark, thanks for calling in. Bill, it's sort of like this is your life. You know, now your former students are calling in to remind you of what it was like. You were a teacher in Milton for many years.
Yes. Yeah.
So you gave out these drawings of race cars?
Yes, I did. Right up until the mid-80s. They started out a little bit rustic, and I got better at it. They got better. But, you know, it's funny. They had a thing on Facebook. You know you're from Milton if – and one of the things was if you know Bill Ladderbush. And – there must have been 25 kids who got on. I say kids, some of them are 50, that said that, Jice, do you still have your pictures? I do.
It's that's
funny.
Great.
Yeah.
Let's bring another voice here into the conversation, talking a little bit about racing today. We're talking about the legacy of auto racing in Vermont, but, you know, there is still racing today. People still do go, and there are people who are trying to keep it alive. Let's talk a little bit about Northeastern Speedway in Waterford. Paul Belfay is the owner of that speedway. It was abandoned in a while ago, but in 2009, Belfay led its restoration, and he joins us now. Hi, Paul. Nice to talk with you.
No, thank you for inviting me in today.
Well, so what in the world made you think, I know, I'm going to take an old abandoned speedway and restore it and, you know, just bring it back into its former glory?
Well, Jane, you know, I guess one can always restore a race car, but it's not every day you can restore a racetrack. So I went on a mission. It was a labor of love, and after a year and a half, I completed it.
And I understand the track was actually in decent shape, but you had to do a lot of clearing out of stumps and trees and bushes to get the, you know, all of the sort of areas around it where the bleachers might have been cleared away and ready again.
Yes, basically it closed at the end of the 66 season, and basically nobody ever disturbed the ground. So trees grew, shrubs grew, and so when I came along in 2007, I basically did it by hand. I didn't want any tractors or skidders in there because I didn't know what I would find or destroy, so I did it by hand, and I burned the brush and the trees, and it came out pretty good.
And now you have an annual event there?
Yes. In 2009, I had an event, the 50th reunion to the day that it opened. It opened July 18th, 1959, and on July 18th, 2009, I had a 50th celebration there, and it went over real well. Great for the community. And then I just had one August 22nd this summer, and again, it went over real well.
Okay, but Paul, why not just bring it back and have races there every Friday night? Come on.
No. I think it looks just fine the way it is, and we can go there and listen to the old flatheads go around the track.
What inspires you about car racing? I mean, why was this just the track that you like, or is there something about the sport that you think is, you know, is vibrant and worth preserving?
I grew up watching the Wild World of Sports in the 70s, playing with Hot Wheels and Matchboxes. I always liked racing. I went to the races at Thunder Road and Catamount Speedy Stadium, and I knew of this track. I didn't know the history of it. As soon as I started clearing it out, people came forward. There was a lot of history there, and I just had a great time with it, and I really enjoy it.
Paul Belfay is the owner of Northeastern Speedway, which, as we've heard, he restored into its former glory and has events there now commemorating what the Speedway was. Paul, thank you so much for telling us a little bit about it.
Well, thank you.
We're talking about auto racing in Vermont. We're hearing some memories from people who grew up with it. You know, some people still able to go. Only about 3 racetracks left in the state where there are races with any frequency. We got a note from Christina who says, my mother's brother, Chet Woods, was one of the original racers at Thunder Road. The stories say he kept it together, his car, with baler twine. She says, I remember a story about plugging a hole in his radiator with hot dog rolls. He was a character, that's for sure. I remember going to Thunder Road during the 60s. My brother, Frank Persons, used to be his pit person before Frank graduated from high school. Bill, these are names that you recognize?
Yeah, Chester T. Wood is definitely something else. One of the other drivers who's still living told me he took his car out once and he said, I was terrified. I looked down, I could see the track flying under me. Chet did use at one point a hay baler seat until they told him he couldn't anymore. He came back in 72, I believe, with this terrible old rusty Plymouth to run at Catamount. And they parked him next to a Massachusetts team that came in with matching haulers and a hired crewman. And they stood there and they just looked at the car. In fact, there's a fellow I know very well from Barrie that was a young mechanic on this fancy car. And they kind of laughed at it and went along their way. And Chet ended up beating that car that day. And they looked at it a little different after that for a while. Yeah, he was a character.
Let's go to Ron, who's on the line with us from Schenectady, New York. Hi, Ron. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment on something Bill said earlier about how expensive it is to race nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
Because I raced Devil's Bowl for 3 years back in the late 90s in the Pro Street Stock Division, and we would be running for like a $300 purse, and these guys would be putting, you know, $6,000-$7,000 in their motors, and, you know, their entire car would cost $15,000, and I just couldn't compete with, you know, I could never run up front.
So, Ron, this was a losing game no matter how you played it, but fun?
Oh, fun. Me and my father would be in the garage building the car all winter long. I'm third-generation driver. Both my father and my uncles all raced, and my grandfather.
Well, Ron, thanks for telling us about it. Appreciate that. And you know, Bill, that is probably one of the concerns these days this kind of sport. I mean, especially at this level where you're never going to have purses that are actually covering the costs of what it costs you to buy the car and to do the maintenance and to keep the parts. Mm-hmm. So, you know, is that going to be a problem for anything
at
this level?
Yes, it is. I mean, in the old days, there were drivers who made a living just racing local stock cars, and that's not going to happen anymore.
So do you see any future for car racing in Vermont at a local level?
I think Thunder Road will remain healthy. I certainly pray the other 2 tracks do as well. And, you know, I'm hoping there will always be a place for the people who enjoy that. Yeah.
What about, though, these days where you can see all of these races on TV or, you know, on your computer, and there are so many competing interests for entertainment? You know, is it a sport that you think is going to stay vibrant even at the top levels?
Well, I don't know about the top levels, but it's nice to get to go because you can't hear them and smell them and stuff the way you can if you go.
Well, and, you know, you have to say it really sounds different if you're at the track than it does on TV. I mean, those engines really have a different sound if you're at a track. So, you know, it's still exciting to you to be there and hear it all?
Oh, absolutely.
That's Bill Ladebush. He runs CatamountStadium.com. It's a website devoted to an old stock car racing track in Milton. He's been with us today telling stories about racing in the Green Mountain State. We should say Bill is also the author of To Beat the Beaver, a biography of legendary driver and Vermont native Beaver Dragon. Bill, what a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me. It was fun.
Coming up, where to put 15,000 letters. It's a problem Middlebury College is excited to have. It's just gotten a long-term loan of a treasure trove of notes from an abolitionist family in Vermont. We'll talk about it next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. I hope when you are writing letters, if you even do that anymore, you think about how they're going to read in, oh, say, 150 years or so. 15,000 letters from 4 generations of one Vermont family, well known for its abolitionism, is now in the hands of the curator of special collections at Middlebury College. The Rokeby Museum in Ferrisburg has given the treasure trove to the college on an extended loan. Here to talk about what the letters actually say is Middlebury Director of Special Collections, Rebecca Irwin. Rebecca, nice to have you on the program again. Nice to talk with you.
Nice to talk with you again, too.
Can you tell me one thing that you found in the letters that either really excited you or has really stuck out to you?
Out of 15,000 letters, it is hard to choose a favorite. But I would say there is a letter that stands out in part because it's been so surprising to Middlebury College students when they've read it. It's a letter, it's actually an exchange by Rowland Robinson, who's something, he was a family's founding patriarch. It's from the spring of 1837, and he's writing to a slave owner in North Carolina. The slave owner's name is Ephraim Elliott, and he's negotiating the release of a fugitive slave who's named Jesse in the letter, who's actually living at Rokeby at the time. So Rowland Robinson thought that letter he wrote to South Carolina was important enough that he made a copy of it, something like an early Xerox. And then we have the letter back from Ephraim Elliott. And in his letter, I guess unsurprisingly, he rejects the offer. Jesse himself, probably by being a hired hand in Ferrisburg, had raised $150, and that was their offer. Ephraim Elliott writes back from North Carolina that he rejects that offer. He won't accept any less than $300, but he promises that should Jesse return, he would not sell him to another owner. Hmm. And that's where the correspondence ends. And that, I think, is surprising for a lot of reasons. In part, perhaps it confirms for Middlebury College students that it is really remote in Vermont, and it won't even get a slave owner from South Carolina up here to retrieve what he saw as property at the time.
And also surprising, it sounds like, because for some people, this idea that you could have a public dialogue like that about this escaped slave is surprising.
That's exactly right. So both of those things, the remoteness of Vermont, the openness at which a slave would have been living, an escaped slave would have been living in Vermont, and just that sense that in an open letter, two men were talking about another human being in terms of property.
Now, you said out of 15,000 letters, it's hard to choose a favorite. There's no way you've read all 15,000.
No, that's right. And I think it is probably likely that not all the letters have been read closely. Certainly, we have an inventory of all the letters, and a lot of hard work has happened by volunteers in the Rokeby Museum over the years. But to say that each letter has been read closely, I don't think that's true, so certainly not by me or perhaps others.
These letters span a really long time period, the 1750s to the 1960s. First of all, that's a lot of correspondence, but why did you want all of it and all of that time period?
Well, I think what makes it so unique is that it is the intact history of a family that lived in a single home in Ferrisburg for that long. So the letters, of course, are just one part of that family's history. The Rokeby Museum still has furniture and artwork and clothes and receipts and journals and farm implements, all of those things, as you said, we kind of recycle without even giving them a second thought. And all of those things together make up the history of this family in a certain place and the history that was going on around them. So I think it's all of those letters together that make them so unique.
And are the later years of this family as noteworthy as the early years? I mean, the Robinson family has become known for being abolitionists in Vermont prior to the Civil War. But later on, are those letters equally valuable?
I think they are. It's what in our mind made the collection so interesting, particularly to Middlebury College. In the later years, there are women who are part of the family and men who are early environmentalists. They're naturalists, they're artists, they move to New York City, they travel around Vermont and New England. And I think for students here in particular who are studying the arts and literature, American studies and history, there's a lot here from a perspective of a single family that they can learn about culture. And you're right, there's a certain Civil War history and abolitionism, but there's also a lot more about the place of women in history in Vermont. And it's quite exciting for those themes too.
As I mentioned, these are on long-term loan from the Rokeby Museum in Ferrisburg, where the Robinson family lived. Now, Ferrisburg is not that far to go for people who might want to read these letters. So why are they now being housed at Middlebury College, and how did that come about?
Well, I think for a few reasons. The Rokeby Museum is only open seasonally. So for researchers or students who want to access the letters, that was difficult there. We're open year-round, of course, so we can provide a research facility for someone who might want to come and see the letters. And I think we're also trying to be not just good neighbors in the Champlain Valley, but also I think museums and archives and libraries all share a responsibility to help take care of these letters. It's hard work for us, and we're also a small archives, but it was really hard work for the Rugby Museum. They have a lot of other things to do and take care of. So in some ways, we're helping each other and sharing the responsibility.
Rebecca, how does this add to the kind of special collections that Middlebury College already has? I think the last time you and I spoke was about a series of letters that the college had just received that were between and among brothers who were fighting in the Civil War. So is this an area of expertise the college is trying to cultivate?
Well, I think in terms of exposing students of this generation, who many were born in the 1990s, to expose them to history that is 150 years old, 175 years old, is a really valuable thing. So the more that we can have in terms of these kind of artifacts is really helpful. But I think, too, this collection of letters, like the Civil War letters we spoke about, they help students see a history that is national in a smaller scale, so they can, I think, feel more grounded in Vermont and get a sense of place here by seeing national issues reflected very locally. So it's exciting when that opportunity comes up, and these letters definitely let us do that.
Rebecca Irwin is the director and curator of special collections at Middlebury College. She's been telling us about 15,000 letters that were just given on long-term loan to the college that document the history of the Robinson family from Ferrisburg. Rebecca, thank you so much.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
And now we're going to take a little bit of time to read some of your comments about recent shows. And I'm joined by Vermont Edition producer Rick Sangari. Hi, Rick.
Hey there, Jane. So last week we discussed jobs, the good, the bad, how to turn the bad ones into good ones, or maybe better ones.
Yeah, and we heard from Erica in Brattleboro about a twist in her career. She says, I started out after college as a paraprofessional in an elementary school, thinking this would enable me to determine whether or not to go on to become a teacher. I did this work for 6 years, enjoyed it, but realized decisively that public school work was not for me. I was inside too much of the time, and I watched teachers spend so much of their work lives dealing with the bureaucracy. I'm now a partner in my husband's furniture business, a serious homesteader, and I homeschool my two kids. So I've ended up in education after all, but in a way that fits with my values, passions, and talents.
Mariana says, my best job was working for folks who treated us well, good pay, great benefits, doing something I loved and feeling proud about my work. They created a workplace that felt like a family. I was there for nearly 30 years until the owners sold the business in order to retire. I now work from home, and I'm very happy doing that, but I do miss the camaraderie of my former coworkers.
Everybody has a story to share about their jobs, don't they, Rick? Lori Ann told us about a less than perfect gig. She says, when I was in high school, I went to the University Mall in South Burlington to find a job. I got hired at a hot dog place. I liked the job, but I remember being written up for waiting on an undercover regional manager posing as a customer because I didn't try to sell up. At closing time, we used to have to actually take the remaining hot dogs off the grill and keep them to put back out for the next day. And Lori Ann says, yuck.
On Friday, we took a look at traffic safety, and we heard from tons of you. Here's what Amy had to say. I've seen so many drivers on the interstate weaving into the fast lane, drifting over into the breakdown lane, and I think, oh my God, that person is so drunk. When I pass them, every single driver I've seen is doing something on their phone. I want to get a dash cam, record it, and send it to the cops.
And Sean posted, I would echo the concerns around appropriate speeds in winter weather. Nothing is worse than trying to concentrate on driving safely in icy conditions than having a car on your tail with brights on.
And finally, on Tuesday, we aired a program that included the sounds, smells, tastes, and voices of the Champlain Valley Fair. And Shannon wrote, with appreciation, your show made me feel as if I went to the fair myself. So many great stories and outstanding sound work and editing and covering all aspects of a good fair. Food, performance, rides, and more.
Thank you for that, Shannon. We had a great time doing that show. And if you didn't get a chance to hear it, check it out. Go to VPR.net and click on Vermont Edition to find the program and listen back.
And while you're on our website, you can leave a comment on any of the shows you've heard, or you can send an email to Vermont Edition at VPR.net.
Thank you, Rick.
Always a pleasure speaking with you, Jane.
And that'll do it for today. This has been a deadly year for bicyclists and motorcyclists in Vermont. Tomorrow on Vermont Edition, we're going to learn about steps the state is taking to improve safety for those on two wheels and to promote public awareness among drivers. If you ride, share your thoughts on what you think should be done. Email vermontedition@vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.